restore somehow popular sovereignty to give back voice and give back decision-making power to the people, and also promise security and prosperity. And it took a lot of time to come out or to become manifest that these promises were not kept up, and that he, on the one hand, continued many of the anti-labor, inequality increasing policies of the earlier period, and he also combined this with generalized graft, corruption, economic mismanagement, plus some kind of a radical right culture, war politics, demonizing minorities, building a border at the southern border, building a wall at the southern border of Hungary against refugees, making campaigns against LGBT people, and so forth. And so basically for a period of time during the 2010s, the post-crisis global regeneration of the economy, generalized growth within the European Union also helped Hungary. So in Hungary, there was also an increase of prosperity, real wages were growing, factories were opening. So there was a wave of reindustrialization as well. And all this for a period of while, for a period, actually managed to hide away the darker side of the government. So the corruption that was present, the authoritarianism that was present. And after the COVID crisis, the war in Ukraine, now the war in Iran, all of them caused more than 4 years of economic stagnation. And this more than 4 years of economic stagnation helped somehow disenchant Hungarians, large part of the population become disenchanted with the government. Also, during these 16 years, the government was very much against the reform, against the improvement of public services. So Hungary has a public education system, a public health system, public railways, buses, so public transportation, and all these infrastructures got deteriorated, active neglect by the government, basically. And by now, the situation became untenable, both in the state of hospitals, for example, or how the every generation of Hungarian students are performing worse and worse on international tests and so forth. So these different strands came together, and Peter Magyar, who used to be a politician in Orban's party. He used to be the husband of the ex-minister for justice in Orban's government. After a public scandal where the government it turned out that the president of the republic, which also belongs to Orban's party, gave pardon to a convicted criminal who was convicted with aiding and abetting a pedophile crime ring a crime. And so basically because of this public scandal, it focused all the anger of the population. And Peter Magyar left behind his party and started talking against it. He's a very charismatic politician. He promises to fix public services, to fix public infrastructure. And he actually spent the last 2 years campaigning in the countryside, going around, holding rallies in places where the earlier opposition never actually went, to places that were considered the strongholds of Orban's party. And through this systematic work of building up a new movement and using the disenchantment of population with economic and social conditions, managed to defeat in a landslide victory.
Szilard, Magyar's rise began after an interview he gave to Partisan in 2024, which went viral. What did he say in that interview? Why did it get so much traction? You're the editor of that magazine, Partisan. And then I also want to ask you about Orban's crackdown on the press.
Mm-hmm. So before Orban could be actually defeated, the old ineffective opposition had to be defeated. So by 2022, the separated or fragmented left-wing and liberal opposition parties became unrepresentatives. They lost an election for the fourth time, so in a landslide again in 2022. And so there was in the anti-Orban camp, or the anti-Orban electorate, there was a generalized disenchantment. And they were looking for a new vessel, a new politician to represent their views, to represent their desire to fight the government. And so basically, Magyar became this person. When he came into our studio, he talked about the fact that the generalized corruption of the system and the unresponsiveness in transparency and the unresponsiveness of the government is actually hurting Hungary. And so basically what he said is that the original promise of Orban was not kept. And this was a message that galvanized a lot of people, coupled with the lack of effective opposition for the previous 12 years. And so these two couple of strands came together and helped Magyar. But when he came into our interview room, he said that he's not planning to make an opposition party. And it was a gradual learning process for him as well. So initially he just started as some kind of a whistleblower, a dissident from a party. And gradually in a couple of months, he realized that the popular forces are pushing him towards actually forming a party, actually forming a movement. And so by the summer, it became clear that he's going to form a party.
Szilard,
this was in 2024.
Szilard Papp, I wanted to end by asking you about Trump's role. You know, he's a close ally, Orban was. In the last days, Vance is sent, the vice president. How was he perceived, and what did it mean for Trump to go as a benefit to a liability?
Yeah, so basically, Viktor Orban was one of the first global politicians to endorse Donald Trump in 2015. And so there was like a very strong relationship, at least in the media. This is how the government media portrayed here. And the war in Ukraine is a very important problem for Hungarians. It caused a lot of anxieties here. It's just over the border. Hungary is neighboring Ukraine, so it's a close issue. And the message that Orban was transferring, it was that with the return of Donald Trump, peace is going to be reestablished and all these kind of things. And it turned out that Donald Trump is not the person of peace, not the representative of peace, but he's actually opening up new fronts, making new global problems that cause Hungarian fuel prices to rise as well. So let's just refer back to your previous discussion about Iran. So basically, it turned out that the whole Trump myth was a hoax. And so this is how it turned around, that the majority of the Hungarian population, as the majority of the European population, so different countries in the EU, see Trump and the US more and more as a competitor, as a threat to global security, as opposed to being an ally or a friend.
Szilard Papp, I want to thank you for being with us, Hungarian journalist and analyst, editor with Partisan, popular Hungarian independent media channel broadcast on YouTube. Coming up, the Trump administration fires six more immigration judges, including the judges who blocked the deportation of Tufts student Rumeysa Öztürk and Columbia student Mohsen Madawi. Both students advocated for Palestinian rights. Back in 20 seconds.
In the Hagerty forsaken, got no reason to cry. You got to chew the angels falling from on high, waiting for no answer, baking woeful pie. Pie of eyesight, pie blue black. Oh, that pie, the pie of bye-bye. Hagerty forsaken, he will leave you one more chance, which if you won't be taken, he'll leave it for the ants. Sings out in the wilderness, sings for friend and foe, he sings of these and those times as well as the times to go. The Hagerty forsaken got no reason to cry. You got to chew the angels. angels.
Hog of the Forsaken by the late folk musician Michael Hurley in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. In immigration news, the Trump administration fired six more immigration judges on Friday in their efforts to reshape immigration policy and the immigration courts. Two of the fired judges, Rupal Patel and Nina Froese, had each dismissed high-profile cases brought by the government against international students who advocated for Palestinian rights. Tufts student Rumeysa Öztürk and Columbia student Mohsen Madawi. Öztürk is a Turkish-born student who is studying at Tufts University after she wrote an op-ed in her student paper critical of the university's response to the student government's stance on Israel's war in Gaza. She was arrested off the street by masked ICE agents. Her student visa had been revoked by Secretary of State Marco Rubio. Boston immigration judge Rupal Patel blocked Öztürk's deportation in January, saying the Homeland Security Department did not have enough evidence to deport her. Öztürk has since completed her doctorate in child development. Mohsen Madawi is a Palestinian green card holder arrested following his participation in campus protests at Columbia University in which he advocated for Palestinian rights. Massachusetts judge Nina Froese blocked his deportation after ruling in February DHS had not proven its case. Unlike judges in the judicial branch, immigration judges are employees of the Justice Department and are hired and fired by the Attorney General. Around 100 immigration judges have been fired by the second Trump administration. Firings in previous administrations were rare. Under Trump, a record number of asylum claims have been denied, leading to a record number of deportation orders. For more, we're joined by two guests. Carmen Maria Rey Caldas is a former judge in New York Immigration Court, appointed in 2022 and fired last year without explanation. She's joining us in our Democracy Now! Studio, and joining us from Washington, longtime immigration attorney Cyrus Mehta. He represents Columbia student Mohsen Madawi. Welcome you both to Democracy Now! Judge, let's begin with you. You were a judge in the immigration court here in New York for 3.5 years before you were fired. Can you respond to what has just taken place for people to understand how rare what is happening is?
The concept of procedural due process, the idea that you get to have a hearing in the United States, whether in immigration court or a criminal court or in federal court, and you have access to a neutral decision maker, is a bedrock principle of law. And I'm not the person to say that. I mean, this is Justice Scalia, who I believe last said that very, very forcefully while he was still alive. And the Supreme Court has recently kind of reiterated that principle in some of the Trump administration rulings regarding Venezuelan nationals. Despite that, the Trump administration has done its utmost to erode that principle by firing judges that it perceived as being opposed to the administration's stated goal to deport as many people as possible with the least amount of due process possible.
Let's bring in Cyrus Mehta. Can you respond to the firing of Judge Nina Froese, the immigration judge who ruled to dismiss the government's deportation case against your client, Mohsen Madawi? She's just been fired. Explain what happened in his case, arrested exactly a year ago tomorrow in Vermont. He was going in for the final stages of becoming a U.S. citizen into a Vermont hearing. He had that hearing, and then the immigration agents moved in. Explain how this firing of the judge will affect his case.
Yes, sure. My client's deportation was based on a document that was issued by Secretary Rubio, indicating that his presence in the U.S. was contrary to our foreign policy. This document was not authenticated. It's an important document. It was being used to deport my client, who is a green card holder, and there was no basis to demonstrate that it was a genuine document. It was issued by Secretary Rubio. These are standard procedures in any court proceeding, including immigration court. The immigration judge correctly terminated the proceeding. We have no basis to know whether that decision caused the firing because she was on probation. We have no idea, but there's a strong inference that this decision may have resulted in her termination because she does not have a very liberal record with regards to granting asylum cases, for example. At this point of time, my client's case was terminated. The government has appealed to the Board of Immigration Appeals. It's independent of this judge's termination. The Board of Immigration Appeals will hear our appeal and could either dismiss the government's appeal or remand back to the immigration court. If the case gets remanded back to immigration court, we won't have the same judge. The firing of an immigration judge is very disturbing. 100 judges or more have been fired. It is egregious because non-citizens are not going to get due process, and they're going to be subject to the ruling of judges that are under pressure. And judges, even if they're employees of the Department of Justice, should be able to neutrally adjudicate cases without any fear of retaliation, regardless of how they rule. For instance, if you win the case before a judge, we don't want the judge to get fired. It makes a mockery of the justice system in the immigration courts.
In the case of Judge
Patel, judges have a lot of power. Yes, go
ahead. In the case of Judge Patel and the case of Judge Froese, they were both presiding over these cases of the Tufts University graduate student, now Mohsen Madawi, a Columbia graduate student. What do you think, first of all, who's being promoted in their place? And what can you do now? Because aren't, like Mohsen's case, in a federal court and an immigration court?
Yeah, that's right. So we don't know who's replacing these judges. Probably the government is hiring new judges that will be more aligned to the Trump administration's policies that are geared towards deporting non-citizens. We're going to do our job. We're going to continue to brief the issue. And if we win at the Board of Immigration Appeals, it's great. If the case gets remanded, we will continue to effectively brief the issue and even bring it into federal court if we have to. And just like every other respondent whose judge may have been terminated, non-citizens need to bring these issues up in their appeals.
Mm. I want to ask Judge Carman, describe the environment these firings create among immigration judges, political pressure on judges, and what's the message being sent out?
You know, it's really interesting because the latest firings have received a lot of attention, in part because both of these judges were presiding over relatively high-profile cases. But judges make decisions over the lives of non-citizens, thousands of non-citizens across the country every day. And we make decisions supposedly based on the record before us, and only that, without undue influence from external sources. But we are still people, which means that when we wake up to a presidential announcement about how liberal judges federal judges need to be taken away from their jobs by Congress, how the Supreme Court is acting improperly when it disagrees with the president, when the executive branch of government fails to respect the independence of the Department of Justice and the courts, that trickles down. And we can't blind ourselves, because we're just people, to the fact that individuals who oppose the interpretation of law that that is being advanced by the Trump administration are fired, when those who support the interpretation of law advanced by the Trump administration are promoted. Whether or not that interpretation is actually correct and in accordance with the laws of the United States. And so people who are judges, who are just people who are trying to feed their children and keep going in the United States of America, have to weigh how much they want to keep their jobs when they decide cases. And that in itself is an unfair putting of weight on the balance of justice in courts.
Were you shocked when you were fired in August? No. You were in one of the most conservative immigration courts.
I was.
Right?
I spent nearly 3 years in Georgia at the Stewart Detention Facility, where I don't think that my grant rates or denial rates were any markedly different from those of my colleagues, in part because we were dealing with a detained population. And in a detained setting, as the Trump administration well knows, which is why it's putting so many immigrants in detention, people abandon their cases. The detention conditions are so horrific that people would rather just be deported. And so we had very high rates of removal. And then I was transferred to the New York Immigration Court shortly before the Trump administration.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. We will continue to follow these cases as the judges are fired and who is being deported and who isn't. Former immigration judge Carmen Maria Rey Caldas was fired in August. Cyrus Mehta, attorney for Mohsen Mahdawi, a Columbia graduate student whose judge was just fired. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. The federal government's preparing to begin automatically registering eligible U.S. men ages 18 to 26 for the military draft pool. The U.S. hasn't had a draft since 1973, but it still maintains a registry of eligible men in case the draft is restored. The new rules around automatic military draft registration were tucked into the 2026 National Defense Authorization Act. In early March, White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt did not rule out President Trump reinstating the draft itself. She was questioned by Fox News host Maria Bartiromo.
Mothers out there are worried that we're going to have a draft, that they're going to see their sons get in and daughters get involved in this. What do you want to say about the president's plans for troops on the ground? As we know, it's been largely an air campaign up until now.
It has been and it will continue to be. And President Trump wisely does not remove options off of the table.
We're joined now by Edward Hasbrook, organizer with the Anti-Draft Coalition, which opposes the plan for automatic registrations calling for repeal of the Military Selective Service Act, editor and publisher of Resisters.info. He is a member of the War Resisters League and the Military Law Task Force of the National Lawyers Guild. His recent piece for Responsible Statecraft is headlined, "Even if Team Trump wanted a military draft would be a fiasco," unquote. In the 1980s, Hasbrook publicly refused to register for the draft and spent 6 months in prison. Can you talk, Edward, about what has changed? What is this draft registry that the Trump administration is bringing back?
Well, since 1980, men have been supposed to register with the Selective Service System within 30 days of their 18th birthday and tell Selective Service within 10 days every time they move until they reach age 26. Very few people do. The efforts to enforce that against a handful of public non-registrants whose public statements could be used to convict us collapsed in the early 1980s. Nobody has been prosecuted in decades. But in the face of growing pressure to recognize the failure of Selective Service and the unavailability of a draft, instead, to save their jobs, the Selective Service System came up with a plan, which they managed to sneak through Congress last year, to give Selective Service a second chance to try to register potential draftees automatically. Now, that won't work because the federal government doesn't have the data they need. But it will produce a database that's highly vulnerable to misuse and weaponization. And even more importantly, it will continue to prop up the myth that the draft is available as a fallback, which in turn enables continued planning for larger, longer wars without war planners having to think about whether enough people would be willing to fight them.
Why do you write that to activate the draft would be a fiasco?
Well, in order to figure out who's supposed to register, the government would need to know current addresses, which they don't have. You don't have to report to the government when you move. They would have to figure out sex as assigned at birth, which is the criteria for eligibility for the draft, which isn't reflected in current records in many cases that show current gender. They'd need to know the names and mailing addresses of every immigrant, including undocumented immigrants who clearly aren't included in current federal databases. So they wouldn't have a database that's either accurate or complete. And in addition, they would have the same problems enforcing an actual draft that they had when they tried to enforce registration back in the 1980s, which are that they could only prosecute people if they could prove that their refusal was knowing and willful, which meant they first had to track them down and provably notify them, which they could do in a handful of cases for show trials, but it didn't really scale. And the reason they abandoned the enforcement of draft registration back in the 1980s was that the prosecutions backfired, and young people got the message that there was safety in silence and safety in numbers. And it's that continued quiet but persistent nonviolent non-cooperation by young people that has been one of the most greatest successes of the peace movement and of nonviolent direct action in past decades that has prevented a draft. We should thank young people for their service in reining in military expansionism.
Shortly after Trump's inauguration, DOGE was sent in and given access to the current Selective Service Registration Database. What's the relationship between the Selective Service System and immigration enforcement?
Well, even before putting in place this plan for automatic draft registration, which will take effect in December, unless in the meantime, in this crucial year, we can get the Selective Service Repeal Act, which will be reintroduced probably quite shortly in Congress. If we can't get that enacted, the change will take effect in December. But what that will do is it will give Selective Service unprecedented power to obtain from any other federal agency any information they think might help them identify or locate potential draftees. Now, even before that took effect, at the end of last year, the Selective Service did give notice that they will be turning over their existing registration list for immigration enforcement and other purposes. And once it goes to DOGE, we don't know what those other purposes are, but given the information in the database, it's particularly likely to be weaponized for other purposes against vulnerable trans and immigrant youth.
And finally, if you don't have a draft, how does it end up? It's poor people who go into the military because they need the financial support, and that's who ends up fighting U.S. wars. We have 30 seconds.
I think the important thing is to take the draft off the table, remove it from the arsenal of war planning, which by forcing the government to confront the question before they make wars of whether enough people will fight them, actually constrains wars before they happen, as opposed to fighting an anti-war movement after they're on.
I want to thank you so much for being with us. Edward Hasbrook, organizer with the Anti-Draft Coalition, will link to your new piece. Even if Team Trump wanted it, a military draft would be a fiasco. That does it for our show. I'll be speaking tonight at the Independent Film Center, IFC, at West 4th and 6th Avenue. Steal the Story, Please. The film about Democracy Now! Continues at the IFC in its first week here in New York City. I'll be doing Q&A with the director, Carl Diehl, and tomorrow as well at 1:30, then headed to the Cinema Arts Center in Huntington, New York, for the screening of the film there. Check our website, democracynow.org. Then we head to Los Angeles, the Lemley Theaters, and the Roxy in San Francisco and beyond. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now!
Thank you for listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby Mountain.
This station and the more than 250 across the country like it need your support. Day in and day out, they bring you the news that matters. They play the music you won't hear anywhere else, and they are a part of this community. You can make sure they get the funding they need to grow by visiting mycri.ca, where you can find all the details about the Community Radio Initiative. It takes less than 5 minutes and a few clicks to generate an email to the politicians who need to hear from you, mycri.ca. Okay.